This podcast takes you into the rarely discussed realm of the personal decisions leaders have taken that have influenced their business decisions and developed them into the leaders they are today. The refreshingly honest experiences of those who have been very successful provide an insight into the challenges they faced, the successes they achieved, and the people who influenced them along their journey. Here's our host, Mark Silvera.
Hey, welcome to Business Made Personal, and really fortunate today to have Joan Fitzpatrick with us. Just to give you guys a bit of background, so Joan Fitzpatrick holds a Bachelor of Laws. She's an ANZIS Fellow, a CIP, a Fellow of the Australian Institute of Company Directors. Her executive and director experience covers corporate, government, and the not-for-profit sectors. Joan originally qualified as a barrister. She went on to hold senior management roles in heavy manufacturing industries, large startup projects in Europe, and international insurance operations in Asia. Most of us will know Joan for her 16 years as the CEO and director of the Australian and New Zealand Institute of Insurance and Finance, or ANZIF. Joan is also the president of the Emergency Services and State Superannuation Board. She is the chair of Sacre Coeur School and the chair of Catholic Church Insurance. In addition to that, her current non-executive directorships include the Defence Bank, Maurice Blackburn Lawyers, the AFL Players Association Injury Fund Foundation Board, bit of a mouthful there, Joan. Her past directorships include the Australian Reinsurance Pool, the VMIA, or the Victorian Managed Insurance Authority. Joan also mentors several aspiring executives who are in transition in their careers, and her charitable activities reflects a strong interest in supporting women and achieving gender equity. We'll speak about that a bit later too, Joan. She is also an Australian by choice, not by birth, and she is constantly grateful for what she says is her blessing. So welcome to the podcast, Joan. It's so nice to speak to you.
It's lovely to be with you, Mark.
Hey, can we start with your home country, Northern Ireland? And more specifically, I think you lived in Belfast. One of the things I read about you was that you mentioned you're a child of the Troubles, and that experience sort of shaped your outlook on life. Just interested to find out what that actually means and how that resonated with you.
Well, when the Troubles started in 1969 in Northern Ireland, and most specifically, most of the activity took place in Belfast, I was 11. And so really, all of my teenage life was dogged by fear and anxiety and, being scared because we were constantly at risk and we were constantly in danger of being shot or blown up or being in the wrong place at the wrong time. One of my brothers was shot for exactly that reason, and he was made into a paraplegic at the age of 17. Just the violence and the lack of control over our lives was really formative. And when I think about what that means for me and what it meant for me as an adult and now into my sort of latter stages of my life, I think I've been really, really against any form of racism or prejudice or unfair bias. Because essentially what was happening to me was that because I belonged to, one side of the violent spectrum, I was labeled and judged. And, nobody ever asked us what we really thought. You know, we were assumed to be in this sort of cohort, and therefore you're guilty and to be blamed. And I think that for many, many people in our world who are treated as second-class citizens or somehow lacking because of their color or their religion or their background, I think it's just intolerable for me. So I've tried to, in my own small way, to fight that at every juncture. And I'm very intolerant of people who show bias or prejudice or any type of ism, sexism, racism, etc.
So, I mean, that's interesting. So I never knew that about you. But how, like, that would have had a major impact in terms of how you see the world and your sort of tenacity in it, I would think.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's an interesting correlation between childhood trauma and the ability to be strong and resilient in later life. I think there's a report that was done years ago, actually when I was CEO at ANZIT, because they talked to me about it because there were very, very few women leaders in the insurance sector. And I think it was Queensland University did a report on the very few in those days women who were sitting in CEO roles. And the university researcher found that the common denominator across all of the women that he interviewed for his research, for I think it might have been for a PhD or something, was that all of the women that were in these leadership roles had all had some sort of formative childhood trauma, like, you know, a terrible divorce between their parents, death in the family, early sickness or illness, you know, all of those sorts of things. And so I found that really interesting because I think that would be one of my core tenets of life, is that you just got to stay resilient and stay strong, no matter what the world throws at you, you know.
And we're experiencing that currently, are we not?
Yes, yes, yes. With the COVID thing, I mean, I think that one of the greatest techniques in an environment like this, in a world where everything, it just seems so terrible constantly, everywhere we look, we're getting horrendous news. I think for us, the important thing to do is to hold on to gratitude and to think about all your blessings, to think about the fact, you know, on a daily basis, I would be saying to my kids, you know, we've got a roof over our heads, we've got jobs, we've got food on the table. You know, those are blessings that we should be really grateful for. And the other thing I often say is, you know, the news is all about the nasties of this world. You rarely hear about the beautiful things that are going on and the generosity and kindness and goodness of people. And I believe very, very much that that will prevail. Regardless of all the troubles we have, that will prevail. People are lovely.
So let's move to the insurance side of things. You moved to Australia, and did you choose to get involved in insurance, or was it more the role that you went for?
Well, my insurance work predated moving to Australia, actually. And in fact, it was the insurance industry that got me into Australia. So I, you know, you said in your intro, you know, I did sort of lots of, I worked across quite a few industry sectors and, you know, had all that sort of manufacturing and production sort of background. And like lots of people, I fell into insurance, which is just, you know, very interesting dynamic in the insurance world, and one that still prevails. I think it's not generally the first choice, it's either the second or third. But I fell into insurance in London. It was a startup company between General Re in America and the Hartford Steam Boiler Inspection and Insurance Company, that venerable ancient machinery breakdown risk company. And they had both saturated, I think, their presence in the North American market at that time, and they wanted to go international. And so they decided to do a 50-50 joint venture, and they set up a company called Engineering Insurance Company Limited in London. And I had, from personal circumstances, had moved country and gone back to London, had spent a lot of time in London. And I had returned to London and was sort of wondering what I was going to do with myself. And a friend said to me, oh, you know, I'm working in this startup company, this insurance company. Do you want to come and help us out with our marketing? And, you know, I thought, oh, okay, better than nothing. And so, I mean, he said to me, you can do marketing, can't you? And I'm going, I'm sure I can. Okay, I'll make it work. And so I sort of found myself reporting to this American CEO and like shadowing him, having to go out with him to clients and having to prepare PowerPoint presentations for him that I'd never used PowerPoint before, had to self-teach all the time. And just became fascinated because what we were doing was the proposition was, you know, we will use our engineers to do a risk evaluation, very much like the factory mutual model. And then, you know, we'll give you a really good premium and a really good underwriting and a plan, a risk management plan that we'll work on with you, etc. So the really lovely model of insurance, you know, that sort of, we'll provide risk cover, but we'll also provide risk improvement advice. And it was just in the time when Margaret Thatcher was selling off most of Britain. And so all the power stations were being privatized. And then guess what? That privatization just marched across the world. India privatized all of their power, Malaysia, some of the Asian countries, Singapore, et cetera, and then Australia and then New Zealand. So my role with them saw me marching across the world because I ended up looking after their Asian customers. They had an office in Hong Kong that didn't really do much, and China hadn't opened up completely. But I wrote a paper to the American board, or to the British board first, and then it went to the American board to say that we should establish ourselves in Kuala Lumpur, because Malaysia was this massively manufacturing, lots of heavy machinery operations. And so I went and set up a business in KL for this company, for the EICL originally, but then Hartford Steam Boiler it became after that, and was there for 4 years. My country's span was the ASEAN. Spent 4 years in airplanes and hotels and built this business. And then they asked me, the Americans asked me to go up to China. I went into China. I was one of the very, I was into China really, really early. So it hadn't opened up. PICC was the only Chinese insurance company, and we insured their nuclear power station at Daya Bay, reinsured it, actually. It was all reinsurance. And then the Americans, in their inimitable fashion, said to me, Joan, do you think you could go into Australia? Because Australia's, Jeff Kennett was selling off the Latrobe Valley, if you remember.
Yep, I do.
And so I came into the Australian market, went to the New Zealand market as well, because was it Contact Energy that New Zealanders were called? I can't remember. They were doing the same thing. So we became these sort of like really amazing company that was really specialist in power stations of all type, nuclear to hydro, you know. And we did really, really interesting work in that area. So when I came into Australia, I ended up marrying a Melbourne man. And I didn't, you know, I couldn't sustain all the travel and didn't want to do that. So anyway, he basically saw the job advert for the Australian Insurance Institute CEO. And he said to me, oh, why don't you go for that? And I said, oh, I'll never get that. It'll be, you know, that'll be something they've already planned out. But lo and behold, I went through a whole series of interviews and got the job.
There you go. When you were in the UK, had you already qualified as a lawyer at that stage?
Oh, yes, yeah. That was several years before. I'd qualified as a barrister and didn't like it.
Oh, okay. I was going to ask what happened.
You have to think, no, this is a long time ago. So my age is, you know, 1981, 82, this was, right? And there were only really, I think there were about 3,500 barristers in the bar of England and Wales. And of that, there were probably only about three women who were successful. And, you know, you're self-employed, of course, as you know. And the sort of advice to me was that I would have to, because I'm a woman, because you're a girl, you're going to have to do family law and, you know, divorce and, oh, you know, child custody and things like that. And I had never even studied that. So I just said, well, I'm not going to do this. But I never really looked back, because I landed a job with 20th Century Fox in London very soon after that decision, and had a fabulous experience with them. Great training, great experience.
So you obviously liked the insurance side. You stayed with the Insurance Institute for 16 years and you've continued even after that. What did it give you that you didn't expect?
Well, you know, I had no idea about it. It was just a complete blank to me as a possible career, you know, no clue about it. And in fact, my father was extremely nervous about me working in insurance, and he had a very negative view of it. And I remember being home in Belfast with him at one stage. We went down to his local pub And I'm sitting with him and all his mates are coming in and they say, oh, hello, Joan, you know, what are you doing now? And my dad would sort of interject and say, oh, she's working for a big international engineering firm. And he sort of dropped the insurance out of it. And I remember saying to my mum the following morning, is dad like, is he like really annoyed with me because I'm in insurance? And she said, oh, you know, he's a bit worried because, you know, doesn't really think much of it. So that was a very common feeling. As it turned out, thank God, my father had the chance then to experience the amazing career that I had. And he was very interested in the fact that he had no clue what it was like. What did it give me that I didn't expect? It gave me a diversity of options and opportunities that I couldn't have dreamt of. It gave me an experience, a span of experience, I suppose, that was just fabulous, really fabulous. And to this day still remains a real core love for me. I really love the industry and love still being connected to it and engaged with it, even much less than I have been in the past. But through Catholic Church Insurance, it's really, really fascinating. I think it's a global industry. People don't really understand that. It's a huge international, global industry. And, you know, through reinsurance, which is where I spent most of my prior life in the reinsurance world, you know, it's just fascinating. There's so much, you know, you can't walk down the street without the insurance industry existing. And one of the great experiences that I had at ANZIF was that we, because I'd had the Asian experience prior, I was very, very interested in how we might export our education product to Asia. And, you know, we watched in that period, Mark, we watched all of Asia start to join the WTO. And as soon as you join the World Trade Organization, guess what? If you're going to have investment coming into the country, foreigners coming in to do business, you need to have a robust insurance industry. And lots of them had, you know, that sort of communist sort of self-insurance mentality. So we were really able to go to those countries and say, we've got an education program, we've got a sophisticated market, albeit a small one in Australia, but it has all the features and aspects of a global play, and we can help you build from the ground up your insurance capability as regulators and your insurance capability as an industry. So so look, I could go on and on, Mark, about the opportunity, the experiences. Like, it's just been amazing. I never expected that I'd stay in it. I thought this is just a quick transition piece. I never expected I'd fall in love with it in terms of its, you know, it's just fascinating, all the answers.
Yeah. Let me change tack for a minute. So you're married, you've got 6 children in total, 4 which you inherited.
Yes.
From your husband's first marriage. What was it like sort of trying to develop a career whilst you had young children?
It was tough. And I think, you know, for a lot of the women that I talk to now, who are going through that exact experience now. You know, I inherited 4 children. You know, I was definitely not, not an easy, they didn't easily accept me at the beginning. And they were going, what's going on here? You know, they were still in trauma from their parents' divorce. They were still really hurt and sore about it all. And even in their own sort of youthful way, hoping that eventually their mom and dad would come back together, which was really never going to happen. So I had to be really, really loving. I think they just needed a lot of love, and they needed a lot of sort of grace to grieve and to find out that maybe they might like me. And then my husband and I, of course, just went ahead and had 2 more ourselves. I really genuinely believe that I, you know, and I say I have 6 children because the 4 older ones are we're very, very close. And, you know, we have a lot of, you know, the 6 children all together see themselves as one unit. And so that's lovely and very fulfilling. But I don't think I slept for about 5 years. And, you know, seriously, like, I was so sleep deprived because, there was somebody was either unwell or unhappy. You know, you're only ever as happy as your happiest, your least happy child, you know. And then we had the two babies, and you know, some of the stories I could tell you about sort of feeding the babies and having to sort of get on a plane at sort of 6 o'clock in the morning, go up to Sydney, get off the plane, go into the ladies, you know, pump, and then go and do some meetings and forget, you know, I had this little bag that the EAs of most of the people at offices that I went to, they just knew, and they would just put it in the fridge for me. And then getting back to the airport at the end of the day and having forgotten the milk supply and, you know, some sort of currying it out to the, you know, oh, you know. So I really empathize with the women who are doing this at the moment and pushing through with their careers, because it is not easy.
What was the driver for you to keep going with the career? You know, because sounds like it was quite a challenge just being home. What was the key aspects that kept you focused on your work?
Well, I have to acknowledge my beautiful husband here, because I couldn't have done it without him. And he stopped work. He had a career, a very sort of senior government career. And he decided that he would stay at home, because we both agreed that neither of us wanted us both working with the kids and all that they needed. And Bernie, I think, was quite happy to also experience his two youngest children as a really full-time father, because he'd been such a part-time father for his first four. So it was a big point of reflection for him. And so he was just fantastic. And, you know, he was just here all the time. And he just put everything in terms of his career away. He was 50 at the time, and he sort of did this. So I don't think I could have done it without him. So I think that sort of strong partnership is really, really key. But I think also that Mark, you know, I've always been a very driven person. I don't know where it comes from. I just think I've got to get this done. I want to achieve these things. I'm aspirational. And I love to drive to an outcome, and so give me a job and I will kill myself doing it. It's sort of like the you remember, but I'm not advocating that for everybody. But I'm just saying it's sort of a personality thing for me that it is you know, a feature of, I suppose, my whole career. Even now, you know, I have a real portfolio of work. I do lots of consulting, and I just can't say no when people say to me, "Do you want to have a look at this?" I go, "Oh yeah, no problem." and then afterwards, I go, "Oh holy moly!" You know, I'm flooded with work. You know, so yeah.
Yeah. Looking back on your career, what would you say has been the most challenging time during it all?
Gosh, there's so many, there are so many big, you know, if I looked at the trajectory of my career like this, there's so many sort of spikes of pain and trouble, you know, but most of it has been, you know, totally fabulous. And not in a Pollyanna way, but, you know, mostly it's been really great. To correlate back to Australia, I think one of the worst disasters in my career was the attempt that we made to form a global insurance institute and to ally our, you know, to have a merger with the Chartered Insurance Institute in London. And in 2008, November 2008, we were supposed to actually, we'd done all of the work, we'd done all of the due diligence, we'd actually even gone to all of our members and talked to them about what it would look like and what it would mean. And then in November 2008, my counterpart, the CEO of CII, phoned me up and said, "We're not going to do it." The Royal Bank of Scotland, which was one of their largest clients, was on the verge of collapse. The British government was having to intervene, and they just felt that they were going to be so distracted by the global financial crisis, which was just starting. If you remember September, October.
Yep.
Yeah. So I think that was heartbreaking and really heartbreaking for the team, and really embarrassing as well from a career perspective, because people looked at it and said, oh, you know, there's some sort of failure going on here, which wasn't true. And so I think that was hard to bear. That would be one of the ones that I'd sort of say wasn't nice.
So what did you do to pick yourself up and dust yourself off?
Well, I'll never forget the actual final sort of, because we tried to sort of persuade this guy to hold firm and stay. And I remember the final disastrous conversation was the night before the Christmas party at ANSIP, actually. And I was onto the board. I was having a board conversation that morning before everybody was going off to their Christmas lunch. And so there was only me and one other person left in the offices. And I sent him off to go and join the party. And, you know, I sat and I had a cry because it was just so devastatingly awful. And you know, we had journalists, the insurance journalists as well, going, oh, you know, we just knew that it was going to be ugly and it was not going to do any of us any good. So I had a cry. And then I sort of thought, oh, well, to hell with this, and went off to the lunch and didn't say anything to anybody. We thought we're going off on our Christmas holidays. So I had a bit of a break to reflect and to breathe again through it and sort of get over the trauma of it, of the failure. And then when we got back after Christmas, I think it was, you know, the day after New Year's Day or something, I took the whole team out for lunch and I said, we're not going anywhere. We're just going to sit here and we're going to get it all off our chests and we're going to do all the purging of pain and hurt and annoyance and anger and all of those things. And so we sat upstairs in one of the restaurants near the office and took over the whole place. There was about 15 or 16 people in that room and everybody just had the chance. You know, we had a speaking spoon. Everybody went around and said, this is how I feel. And it was a lot. And of course, we had some wine and we were able to laugh at it, too. And so that was it was almost like a wake, a funeral wake for the project. And we just said, OK, that's it. We've got to go now. Let's pick ourselves up and go forward because there's plenty of other things. And by the way, we were facing into at that stage, that first quarter of 2019, we lost 30% of our business. You know, and you know, we were really frightened that it was going to put us into real difficulty, although we had money in the bank by then. So, you know, we had plenty to get on with and plenty to distract us from just worrying about the failure.
It would have reflected, I would imagine, that you would have felt it would have reflected on you as the leader.
Yeah.
And that there would have been people taking pot shots all over the shop, I would have thought.
There were. And like we'd spent, you know, 3 years and some significant money on this project, you know. So, you know, of course it's going to attract, you know, criticism. The other thing was that I'd sat down in front of every single CEO and explained to them what I was doing and why we were trying to do this thing. And, you know, personally put myself on the line really for it. And so, definitely. I mean, I can sort of understand that people would take pot shots, but you got to just grin and bear it and move on. Yeah,
I've been in that situation myself. No, nowhere near at the level that you have, but it took me a long time to just get my self-confidence back.
Yes.
I don't know how you went with it all.
Yeah. Well, you sort of. You're bruised, there's no two ways about it. And you sort of, your confidence takes a knock and you sort of find that you're almost second guessing yourself for a while. And you know, I did do that around some of the bigger projects that we could have embarked on. I sort of thought, oh, hang on a minute. And I think I was more risk averse for probably 2 years after that. You know, really, really, I'm not going to take a big risk.
So just in terms of your career, has there been anyone that you've looked at as a mentor or that's helped you in terms of, you know, with, you know, as a sounding board or any of that sort of jazz? Have you had a sort of pivotal person in your life?
I've had several. I mean, probably, you know, too many to list, because, and I probably offend somebody by forgetting them. But I think in the early days in the market, in this market, you know, when I first became the CEO of AII, as it was then, you know, it was sort of almost insolvent. It was on its knees. It was irrelevant. It was, you know, largely populated by a small cohort of industry players. And, you know, the vast majority of the industry didn't have a relationship with it. And so I had to, you know, I had to confront the fact that a lot of people didn't like what I was doing in terms of changing the organization and, you know, bringing it back to really good solvency, bringing it back to money in the bank and, you know, really good reserves, and shedding some of the old practices. And, you know, there was a lot of history to the organization. It's one of the oldest institutes in the world to this day. It has had a continuous history that is very long and venerable. And so facing into the absolute vitriol, I mean, it was really vitriolic at times in those early years from certain people in the industry was hard. And I was really, really lucky because I had three consecutive guys who were the chair of my board and who really backed me in. So John Cloney from QBE was probably absolutely gave me the imprimatur, because what he did was he took me around the industry when I first started. And just by sheer dint of it being John Cloney, you know, no matter how good or bad I was, I got a tick from everybody because it was his silent endorsement, you know. David Sando, you know, who was sort of at Zurich at the time, and then Finity, he helped create Finity, as you probably recall. David Sando to this day is still in contact. He sent me a birthday email. He and his wife Pam sent me a birthday email last week, and just the most beautiful man, but totally steadfast. And even though he also, you know, received some real criticism around backing us in terms of what we needed to do to fix the organization and make it relevant for the industry. And then the third is probably John Richardson from Marsh, who actually, the very first time I met him, I was terrified of him. Actually, he was so difficult to read. I couldn't read him. You're going to kill me for saying this. He too has been one of the most consistent, good advisors to me. He would often, I remember him saying to me once, we went out in the middle of a very, very tense board meeting, and we all went to the kitchen to make ourselves a cup of coffee in a break. And he just came up to me and said, "Joan," he said, "just breathe. Just don't say anything. Just let it go." He was very good. He's very good. So I think those three, they're so lovely and still such a part of my life as well. So really grateful to the three of them.
Yeah. Oh, he's still in the industry too, isn't he?
Yeah. Yeah.
Hey, let's talk a little bit about women in insurance. I know it's a passion of yours. Yes. I can see you nodding away there. what do you see as being the challenges that women are facing in this industry?
I think the challenges are a lot less than they were. I think that's for sure. I think the past 20 years has seen a much more broad-minded view of women and women's seniority and women's capability than ever before. And I think, you know, there were some champions like Michael Hawker at IAG, Duncan West, you know, people in the industry who have, you know, just gone and done it, appointed women, put them in positions of seniority, and then supported them, you know, didn't set them up to fail, you know. And I think women had for many, many years, in my observation, always been the sort of the engine room of the insurance industry. You know, they're always sort of sitting in those levels just below executive and CEO. So they were very, very capable. It was just that they never seemed to get promoted and they never seemed to get the big jobs. And I just couldn't understand it. And interestingly, when I started on this sort of bandwagon of mine, which was to sort of try to encourage women, and we set up that Women in Insurance group, and you know, we set up our committees, and we wanted women to have a voice, and how do we give them a voice? I think the universal issues of difficulty with childcare, not good on ramp or off ramping for maternity leave, and then on ramping back on, you know, really sort of not even having the self belief as well for some of the women was problematic. It has been for centuries a very male dominated industry, as we know, and as a consequence, it's taken time to unravel that. And we were definitely about a decade behind the banks and other financial sort of services segments. But I think it's better now. It's still not right. But I think that just socially in the workforce, you know, gender equity is absolutely being mandated now, which is fantastic. And I think, was it only this week they announced that there was no ASX company in Australia that didn't have women on the board, which is just like, whoa, you know. So I think a lot of those horrendous barriers are being broken, and I can see it. I watch what's going on. It's still not enough. You know, it's still a bit sort of slow, but I think at least the mindset is much more open now than it was.
It's an interesting one because, you know, from my perspective, I think what I've seen, particularly in the insurance sector over the last 40 years, women aren't that good at promoting themselves.
That's it. That's the big problem. Women don't ask. You know, we've all been socialized into, you know, nice girls don't ask, you know, and when we were all children, you know, I grew up with four older brothers, and my mother was the right sort of, what's the word, force of nature. And so she had my brothers doing equal shares of the housework from they were able to hold a broom or, you know, wipe a table. And so she had that sort of really strong view that that we were all equal. I think, nevertheless, I think, you know, women are socialized into this view that they can't ask, they shouldn't ask, and they shouldn't put themselves forward. And all these horrible negative labels that come against women like me: oh, she's so pushy, oh, she's so full of herself, oh, she's so ambitious, oh, you know, this, that, and the other. And they're really negative framings for women who are able to speak up for themselves and able to, you know, push forward. Whereas if it's a guy doing that, he's seen as, oh, wow, isn't he dynamic?
And, oh, yeah, absolutely, 100%.
You know, 100%. And I think that we need to persuade our women to ask for what they deserve, you know, not to have a sense of entitlement, because entitlement is all wrong as well, but actually to really be self-aware. And I think one of the greatest insights that I was given when I was a young woman supervising staff for the very first time, like at the age of about 23, my boss at the time, who was a very rough and ready East End of Londoner, but a very, very bright guy, he said to me, Joan, the secret of success is to never underestimate yourself and to never overestimate yourself, but to know exactly how strong and how weak you are and where your areas of you know, greatest ability are, and to fill the gaps, do the learning, find the education, find the experience to fill the gaps. And I think that that's the thing that I really keep on saying to the women that I talk to. Don't allow somebody else to tell you what you can or cannot do. Know yourself, what you're capable of. But, you know, evaluate yourself accurately. So I agree. We have to sort of persuade our women in the industry to be really confident.
Yeah.
That they can do the jobs.
And I think the good thing is we're starting to see that come through a little bit. I think there's still a long way to go, don't get me wrong, but I think we're starting to see some change, but it's been a long time coming.
Oh, it's been horrendous. Horrendous. I mean, we still don't have very many. Do we have any CEOs in heading up on the life side, yes, but not on the general insurance side.
Only at ANZIF.
Yeah. You know, so, yeah, it's pretty poor.
Interesting. Hey, if you look back over the last sort of 5 to 10 years, you know, much has changed in our industry, right? I just want to quote something from you in your departing speech from ANZIF in 2013. Are you ready? You said that the numbers of people employed would continuously decline due to the impacts of technology and industry consolidation. What have you seen that happen? Do you think that's still going on? What's your view today, sort of, what, 8 years later?
Look, it has. It probably hasn't to the. It hasn't in terms of the reduction of staff. I think it has continued. That if you looked at the graph, it's still a continuous sort of drop in terms of numbers employed. I think it has. It's been slower, or the time frame's been longer for that decline happening than I had expected. And I think that's mainly because the insurance industry has not been great adapting to new technologies and really embracing new technologies. And there's been a lot of sort of starts and stops in that area. I think that's going to bite us on the bum eventually, actually. I think we're going to have to really ramp up that tech capability. I think the... you know, you've got organizations like Lemonade, for example. That's a really good proxy for the future, I think. But Lemonade is dealing in very simple insurance products. So I think that there's it's a segmented issue around how much you can digitally service simple, uncomplex insurance products, and how much you, in terms of the more complex insurance products, we still need a people response. I still think there's, that when I first started in the insurance industry, everybody told me that the brokers were dying. They were never going to survive. Here we are. They're still going strong. They've just iterated themselves into different shapes and different cohorts in terms of how to respond to the market. So I still think there's always going to be a role for intermediaries. There's always going to be, insurance factories, the manufacturing sort of delivery. But I think we're going to have to deal with a very changing customer base. And I think the reality of tailored bespoke insurance only when I need it is going to swamp us. I think the road traffic the car insurance is going to be a massive shift. It's we thought it would be sooner, but it's on its way. It'll be this decade. Driverless cars or cars that just don't crash, basically. So we're going to want to buy insurance only for the days we're driving. You know, that's already starting to happen, and I can see it happening across some of the other product lines as well.
So Joan, I just want to go back. So again, in 2013. Another comment from you, which I loved. I've moved away from the idea that you don't positively discriminate in favour of women. It will simply happen on merit, to the view that proactively pushing the agenda, even in a small way, is important. So the Women's Council was created and the Women Succeeding in Business program launched. I know we've spoken about the challenges women have in terms of expressing themselves in this market, but have you seen things like changes in things like gender imbalance, but more importantly, pay differentials for women?
Yes, I have. I have seen good improvement on sort of the pay differentials. It's not been driven by the insurance industry itself. It's actually been driven by society. So we've got the WGEA. If you're over 100 employees, you have to complete this gender equity survey every year, and that gets up on your website. And so suddenly, it's almost being mandated. So I think a lot of companies are working towards that and interrogating the gap between like-for-like roles in terms of salaries and things like that. So I think that momentum is happening. I think in Victoria, we're really lucky because the government has invested a lot of money in women's workplace gender equality issues, and we've also got the respect sort of organizations setting up to try to sort of defend women from any form of violence. So I think there's lots of good progress, and it's probably been in the last 3 or 4 years. Actually, it hasn't been, you know, a lot of it's come from the external world or government regulation. But I do see in the insurance industry area that I'm involved in a real desire to ensure that our women are paid on parity and are treated with you know, the same sort of respect, have the same career opportunities. Because there's a lot of unspoken advantages or unnamed advantages that men quite often get. They get the courses, they get sent away overseas, they get the experiences, they get the conferences and things like that, you know. So I think that we are, as an industry, much more alive to it. And guess what? By sheer necessity, because there's such brilliance in the female cohort in the industry that you know, they'd be fools not to tap into it. And
oh, definitely.
So I mean, when I made that statement, Mark, I was talking about you know, just being impatient with the fact that, you know, we really need to do more to mandate it. And so I was sort of even pivoting into, you know, we need quotas, you know, let's do quotas. And, you know, cause I was so fed up with, you know, waiting for this revolution and gender equity to happen. But yeah.
Well, you were ahead of the time when you made that comment, I think. Hey, a couple of final questions. If you were joining the industry today, what sort of advice would you give someone coming in, or someone who's been in it just for a few years? What are the sorts of things you think they should be looking at or looking out for?
I think understand the breadth of opportunity that it offers. I think that would be one thing that I would say. You know, you might go in as a junior into one of the big insurance companies at the moment, but just take time to understand that there is a huge span of opportunity within that one organization. You know, you can go across from, you know, underwriting claims, you know, sales, marketing, product design. I mean, there's a whole sort of gamut of aspects to that one organization that you can explore and learn in. So I think that's that. I think, you know, even thinking more sort of high level, you know, the opportunity to sort of be an underwriter, be a loss adjuster, be a claims handler, be a specialist in some area, be a broker, be an underwriting agent. You know, like, it's just such a beautiful raft of opportunities, and your whatever you learn in your role is infinitely transferable. That's the other thing everybody forgets. You know, they think, oh God, you know, I'm here, can I make that shift? And I think, you know, trust yourself that, you know, learn as much as you can, work hard, and know that, you know, you'll be of value if you want to shift into a you know, a different area of the industry. My advice, probably, you know, work hard, learn as much as you can, and be as self-aware as you possibly can. You know, that whole don't overestimate yourself, but neither should you underestimate yourself. And be confident, you know, have the confidence to know that, you know, with time, it'll, you know, you will grow in your capability, and it will come to you if you give it time.
And that's a beautiful segue, because you have, you know, developed expertise and experience across a broad range of services in the sector. So what are you doing today?
Well, I sort of do three buckets. So I have the portfolio of non-executive director roles, which I have loved doing. And I've been a director since 1998. So I've really loved that board role environment. And I still love it. And I'm very passionate about the companies that I'm on the board of. And then the second thing I do is I do quite a bit of consulting. And I, Mark, you'll remember how hot to trot we've always been at ANZIF on strategy.
Yep.
Remember all of
yep.
the strategy stuff?
Absolutely.
I'm a big pusher of, you know, really great strategic planning. And it's done so badly, you know, in many, many ways. So doing it really well is good. And I do a lot of sort of risk and governance consulting, and also, I you know, sort of supporting teams that are having difficulties gelling or taking really good high performance leaps. And then the third thing I do is the pro bono stuff, is all the charity stuff. So I do a lot of charity work as much as I can fit in. And I love, my special focus is on women. So I do charity. I've been supporting sort of Women's Property Initiative, the Queen Victoria Women's Centre, the Equal Workplace Advisory Council of the Government, the Gender Equity Advisory Council of the Government, and you know, Impact for Women, those sorts of things, and those sorts of small charities for women. And then I mentor one-on-one women who are sort of thinking about, what do I do next? Where at? Who am I? Why am I doing this stuff? You know, who are questioning everything about their career.
Yeah. Hey, it's been an absolute pleasure to have you on Business Made Personal. So I really, really appreciated you spending time with us.
It's lovely to be with you, Mark.
Thank you so much for lending us your ears. Please remember to click follow on your podcast app or subscribe at bmppodcast.com.au so we can give you a sneak peek of our next guest. Until next time, I'm Mark Silvera, and you've been listening to Business Made Personal.